democracy in your hands. I think we all believe that. So with no more ado, let me tell you the format of this event. It's, I think, going to go very quickly, but we're all prepared to talk about the things we care most passionately about. So for the first 45 minutes, the panelists will be answering questions posed by me, the moderator, and then we'll open it up for discussion from questions in the audience. So let me now introduce panelists. To begin with, we have Michelle Donaldson, who's the Vice President and General Manager of KOB, the NBC affiliate in Albuquerque. There's Inez Russell Gomez, the editorial page editor of the Santa Fe New Mexican. Kaylin Goodluck of High Country News, a contributing editor who's based in Albuquerque. Fred Martino, director of content at KRWG in Las Cruces. And finally, Jessica Ansouras, the news director of the Carlsbad Current Argus. So as I was saying, we have several goals today. And among those, as I was thinking about it, is the fact that we journalists often don't really do a very good job in telling our own story. Surveys show that many Americans think that journalism is actually in, you know, fine fiddle right now, and just, you know, quite the opposite is true. Michelle, can you just talk to us a little bit about what the state of your newsroom is and whether you think the media, well, how is the media doing right now?
I would say that we have the flu, right? Or the super flu. Thank you, COVID. I would say on a content side, our newsrooms, all of us collectively, we were built for moments like this, right? We are living through the story of our lifetime. And from a content side, I know all of us are doing an incredible job serving our community during this crisis. And we had to make some changes to how we normally work. We had to make immediate changes in workflow. We had to adapt and innovate in order to keep going and to keep our team safe. What we weren't prepared for, and is a continuation of a trend that happened long before COVID, was the economic impact on our operations. And before COVID, we were already seeing a decline in advertising revenue for everybody, right? And we can talk about the reasons for that. I always talk about the biggies, Facebook and Google, and the advertising dollars that they have taken or siphoned from traditional journalism outlets, although they themselves create no journalism product. They profit from what we create. But then you add a pandemic and an economic crisis to the mix. So at a time when our work was more important than ever, and the viewership, and I'm sure the readership, was higher than it has been in a long time, as people rediscovered the importance and relevance of local trusted journalism, we found it very difficult to, in our business, sell a commercial. That was the irony of it. We have businesses that have been closed for quite some time, and even ones that have reopened that don't have inventory or who have questions about the long-term future. And it has really destabilized an already precarious situation, I think, which is the primary funding source for the important work of journalism.
So how do you find the media today being equipped to handle such complex problems as this pandemic and all the other issues that we're facing at such a precarious time?
Again, I'll tackle that from two sides. From a content side, I feel rock solid. I feel good about the decisions we're making. You know, New Mexico and the Four Corners region have had some very unique things that we're living through. And I'm really exceptionally proud of the work we're doing and the work our colleagues are doing to serve these communities, some very different communities far flung throughout our area. At the same time, it's a question of hard choices. So I got expenses running out the door, is a good way to put it, because you have a responsibility to serve the public right now. And the revenue side is really hurting because of what's happening with the economy. I have made reductions in my own business. I'll be honest and upfront about that, but I've worked really hard to keep them out of the newsroom at this point. What are the long-term consequences of that? I'm not 100% sure. It's a little bit like treading water. We've been treading water for 6 months now. I think when we all started this, we thought we might do it for a couple months and things would stabilize and we'd find a get our footing again. And I'm feeling like it's probably at least another year before anybody feels like they have their footing again.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that's what we're starting to come to terms with at Searchlight as well. One of the comments, actually numerous comments from people who registered for this event, brought up the 2016 election and how badly the press called it then and even covered what was really kind of happening on the ground. Now the media are just the rest of the country is so polarized that it's sometimes hard to tell the difference between, you know, opinion and fact. Inez, what do you think? I mean, how can the press get back to its root of just covering the news? And is it just the job to only cover the news and just give me the facts and nothing else without context? What's proper in your opinion?
Well, I'm lucky because I edit the opinion page. So my job is to have fact-based opinions, both in our editorials and in letters to the editor. And one of the interesting things of editing letters now, in my views, which are the reader opinion pieces, is that so many of them are based, not many of them, but at least a sizable amount are based on crazy facts. They're not real. So it's very hard to tell someone, I can't run your letter because what you're saying is not real. It's not true. No, COVID is not a hoax. This isn't happening. So you have to be really careful to respect people's opinions while at the same time not let an opinion be an excuse to get, as the president calls it, fake news on our pages. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, just the facts, if you go back to the history of the yellow press and the beginnings of journalism, there were a time when journalism was used by newspaper owners basically to present a particular point of view. We never were definitely just opinion-based. I mean, we were never just fact-based. So that's kind of a myth. And then even as you get to the five W's and we're going to present things, if you're coming at it from a position of power in a system, if you're presenting that set of facts, it's biased anyway. So what I think we have to do is be more nuanced today and tell a story objectively and fairly, but also kind of report the broader conditions. Christine Amanpour said once really beautifully when she was covering Kosovo, she could not present both sides in Kosovo because one side was evil and one side was not evil. And I'm not gonna say that's what's happening in the country necessarily, but if you have two sides with points of view and one of them is a lying all the time and one of them is not, if you just presented them side by side without any interpretation or without any context, you would be failing as a journalist. And perhaps that's part of what happened in 2016 with the national media, mm-hmm. is they turned the cameras on and let the candidate Trump speak and never slowed down. And was that a good thing or not? I don't, you know, we could argue about that.
I think so you could say the same thing with, the coverage of climate change for many, many years took that same approach. Let's go to the other side and see the deniers. And what do the deniers say? And giving them exactly the same credibility that we were giving real science. And I think that we really did, an injustice in doing so. But Kaylin, you really deal with these questions a lot, I understand. Certainly, like in the last few months, you've spent much of your reporting covering Black Lives Matter and the protests. You wrote a story about the history of police brutality in Albuquerque, which really kind of deconstructed all the myths around police brutality and how stories should be covered in an honest and truthful way, if not an absolutely objective way. So tell us about what you think about the trust issue. Is there any trust left in this system? And what's the role of journalism in covering these kinds of issues?
Yeah, I think just a boilerplate answer for journalism in covering police brutality is, we're meant to be holding institutions accountable, right? But I think that I see a lot of coverage here, using only police sources, and stories end up just being police press releases, which is really not good, I think. And I think that really does a disservice to your viewers or your readers. And I think that taking a step back and saying, are we really covering crime or are we covering policing? And I think that when I turn on the news at night, I see that there was a burglary or a robbery. I see homelessness. I saw an article the other day about, the headline was something like homeless camp scares off neighbors. And we have a huge problem with homelessness in Albuquerque, yet homelessness is demonized. And it takes very much a lens of law and order where homelessness equals crime, homelessness equals drugs. And it's those kinds of stories are extremely damaging, but they're also the police narratives. That's how they approach their own worldview, and that's how they want the public to view them as. And I think I think just recent protests with Black Lives Matter, or even removing of colonial statues or Confederate statues, those types of events have shown how police are really there to protect property in a lot of ways. They're there to enforce a certain kind of status quo, and that they end up brutalizing protesters. Yet protests are often demonized, they always have that potential in the police or the public's mind to turn violent when the vast majority of these protests are peaceful. So I think it's important to look at the documents. And I think there have been really good student journalists who have been covering the protests far more than I have been, that have been looking at police reports and have been scouring cell phone footage and cross-referencing what the police have said had happened, and then actually looking at from different angles how events actually went down. And then you begin to unfold where police, knowingly lie. Police have often lied.
So
I could go on and on, but I think the point is that, you shouldn't be taking what the police say at face value. And in fact, you should be scrutinizing what each of their statements are.
I just wonder, is there also a risk in taking reports from people in the community, citizen journalists, as you would, who you know, have not been trained to vet and do reporting and fact checking and, you know, looking at various reports and putting them in contrast with one another and making sure that everybody is called, everybody who's mentioned in a story. I mean, that is the also the rigors of classical journalism. What do we lose when we go to the social media kind of response to that?
Well, first of all, I'd say it's more damaging to take police at their word rather than, you know, I'm not saying don't scrutinize what, you know, the sources, the other sources, say the community activists that you have. I think you always double check their work just as you would, you know, the police. You would double check their work before you report it. I think that there was this story about the cheesesteak story. I believe it was, which outlet reported it? One of the local breaking news outlets reported it. And it was just police statements about how violent extremist militia men had taken over this cheesesteak restaurant. But then they only interviewed one activist, and the activist said that, like, we're just here protesting police brutality. And that was the only quote. The rest was just police. Mm-hmm. And I think that's far more damaging than, you know, recognizing that other people do good work to hold police and these institutions accountable. And you find out who is really credible in those instances.
Fred, do you want to have something to respond to this? I know down in Las Cruces, you have at this point two reporters, is that correct? Who are covering the news. It must be pretty challenging at times.
Yeah, I mean, staffing is always a challenge. One of the things that, you know, we try to do here that I think is something that probably collectively in journalism we have to look more at is working with others. So we actually once a week have Jessica talk about Alamogordo on our radio stations. We have a segment from her. We also have two other newspapers that we work with, the Las Cruces Bulletin and the Las Cruces Sun News, that do radio segments with us. You know, I'm glad we have a representative, Inez from the New Mexican, on the editorial page side. This is something else that we do, and we have an incredibly wide variety of opinion pieces on our website. And we also have a couple of those that run on the radio. So we have a couple of columnists who do audio versions of their columns. And that's an important part of our overall content mix. But, you know, to your original point, capacity is huge. I mean, if we could have more reporters in more places, certainly we could improve the coverage that we offer. And to Kaylin's point about the police and only presenting their view in a story, I think we see this in other types of reporting as well, and it's a real concern that you only have one view, or the even more common thing is that you have multiple views, but you allow individuals sometimes to present information that's either incorrect or is out of context. And that's another problem. So it's fine to have both sides, so to speak, when they're simply giving opinions. But if they're making what what are designed as statements of fact, and there are falsehoods in that, it's just critical to follow up on that in the story. And that's something, unfortunately, I've seen more of over the last few years. And it's something that collectively we have to own up to and talk about, because it's very damaging. To add credibility to false information or information that's out of context by placing it in a news story.
Right, whether it comes from social media or the police.
Or anyone. Yeah, any source. I mean, I saw a story this week that I guess the Washington Post is keeping track of falsehoods by President Trump, and said there were 20,000 since he took office. I mean, that's just overwhelming. It's just amazing. And you know, I know that's a debate that we've had in journalism since 2016. How do we present that? And as you all know, there was this original debate about, well, we shouldn't use the word lie because that implies intention. And I guess, you know, now I am seeing not the word lie, which is fine, but I am seeing falsehood more often, which is I think accurate in some cases, that there's a falsehood that's being said. And that's important. That's really important to call that out. Misstatement is not the right word, in my opinion, very often, because if someone misstates things over and over again, and they've been corrected, by saying misstatements, we imply that it's just an error. It's an unintentional thing. And we don't know that, right? I mean, so falsehood is probably a very good word, an accurate word to use a lot in cases like this. And it's important for us as journalists to do that. That being said, I know this is much harder today because we have this unfortunate dynamic in the country right now where I think individuals have been emboldened to attack journalists and attack journalism due to the environment that we're in. And I think that may be affecting some individuals who are a little bit concerned about how they present material. And so I think we've got to fight against that.
Can I ask, like, maybe a show of hands, who among you has been attacked because you're a journalist, either verbally at a dinner party, or we all have?
Sure.
We all have. Sure. Yeah. It's pretty disconcerting when it happens. I've always been so proud to call myself a journalist. I thought, you know, I was doing something so wonderful, and you realize that people really hate you. There are people out there who really just see that as it's a red flag to a whole.
Well, and Sarah, I don't know how you feel about this, and if you've ever had to have conversations with individuals. I also think, you know, more often than people hating, I notice in the times when I've been able to have discussions, I notice a lot of misconception that an awful lot of these people who may deride journalists or journalism think that we have an agenda, that we, you know, when we're presenting information, that we have some kind of an agenda to present a certain view, as opposed to the real agenda, which is to present the facts as we can, as best we can. So you know,
I remember years ago, there was always the assumption that journalists were liberal, but there have been a number of studies, and this is really going back more than a decade, to the political leanings of journalists. And the majority of them, or at least half of them, like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, were pretty conservative politically. They were not necessarily rabble rousers. They were church going, you know, like very kind of mainstream political people. And so that's, I think, also part of the misconception. Jessica, I wanted to ask you, you are sitting kind of in this little wedge of Southern New Mexico, which is more red, more GOP than Democrat. And it's very unique here in this state. You have, you know, interests and readers who are really very kind of on a whole other kind of side of politics than the rest of New Mexico. And so I'd like to hear how you, you know, how it, that impacts the way you, you know, talk to them, the way you, the kinds of criticism that you've received, the trust that you have built up with the community. What do you have to do differently that the rest of us don't generally think about?
You know, so yes, you're right. We're in a very red part of a very blue state, as I like to say. And I think the key to that, to managing that, is a couple of things, which is we think of ourselves as community journalists. We think of ourselves as boots on the ground every day. So the people who are reading us, who are interpreting what we're writing and taking all that information in, are people that we see every day and we have conversations with. And I always tell my journalists that a large part of our job is to go out there and educate everyone we come in contact with about how journalism is done, how we function on a daily basis, how we choose what questions to ask, how we choose what to cover. And as we go about that education, I think we're able to better mitigate some of this idea that we are a very left-leaning industry, we're a very liberal industry, that we come at our reporting with, like Fred said, an agenda that we just want everybody to fall in line. So that's the biggest key to what we do on a regular basis. But then we also have to take a step back and we have to realize that what we're reporting in our part of the state is getting read at a larger, amongst a larger readership. We're part of the USA Today network in Carlsbad. And that means that the reporting that we do here on very critical topics like oil and gas, methane pollution, and, you know, things like revenue generating industry, the rest of the state, that gets read by a larger audience. So we're also trying to balance that with those basic journalism standards, which are, you know, is what we're reporting fair? Does it offer that broader view and perspectives that will help people be informed to make decisions? I don't think any of us, everybody raised their hand when you asked the question. None of us have been immune from that label of fake news or having our journalism called into question. And we don't want to spend all of our time defending ourselves. Obviously, that takes up way too much time to kind of just address every issue. But we also want to be very upfront about who we are and what we do. And that's always been a key point for us. And the other thing is, too, is that, you know, we get it from both types of readers. We've got the very conservative reader who calls what we do liberal journalism. And we've got the very liberal reader who calls what we do, because we're in this part of the state, very conservative journalism as well. You know, you just do the best you can. You try to stick to those ethics and those morals and those codes of good journalism and take it as it comes.
One of the things that's struck me about the work you do is that you are the editor of three newspapers, yeah. Which is just mind blowing. I can barely handle one. So tell me, tell us how, what the papers are and how you straddle from one to the other.
Well, you know, we are in an industry that is ever changing. We're trying to find a revenue model that works, that can help sustain what we do. And I, you know, with respect to everybody else on the panel, I feel like sometimes community newspapers take it a little bit harder than the others. So I am managing the Carlsbad Current Argus, which is based out of Carlsbad, the Alamogordo Daily News, which is in Alamogordo, and the Ruidoso News. And all three are, you know, papers that have been in their communities for generations have done great work in the past, but we're at a very tough point right now. I've managed a staff of five now. We went through some personnel reductions earlier this year, which has completely impacted how we're able to do what we do, and really caused more questions about, you know, where does journalism stand these days. But I think on a daily basis, it's about keeping to our roots as community newspapers, attending those, you know, county and city meetings, making sure that we're in tune with what's important to our readers. We have to make some very tough decisions about what we can dig into and how we spend our time and our resources. My journalists are great. They're very gung-ho. They're very dedicated to what they do and to their community. So that always helps. But as an editor, it's tough because we ask more of them these days than we did in the past. I've been doing this job for a couple of years now. And I know when I started as a reporter, my job was to write. And now my reporter's job is to write, to take pictures, to grab video, to post to social media, to answer people on social media, to go back and do a follow-up. And all of these things together and be savvy in multimedia just creates a really interesting environment for journalism. I think in some ways we're better able to tell our community stories, but also in some ways we're more challenged when it comes to doing it well.
And so how do you actually make your priorities and decide when to, you know, like choose one story after over another? What are the, you know, kind of the hallmarks mm-hmm. that, you know, suggest to you a really good story that needs to be covered in your area?
We do a couple of different things, but I had a conversation with the journalist earlier today about what we call institutional knowledge, which is that knowledge that we have about who we're covering, the communities that we're covering, that comes with years of experience. Now, when I started the Kern Argus, we lost a reporter who had been here for 35 years. Imagine the amount of knowledge that went with her when she left our newsroom. And we're seeing that more and more. In my time here, we've had reporters who've come in, stayed for a year or two and then left, and they still take that institutional knowledge with them. So we're trying to be better about giving our reporters incentives to work in small communities. And as they do that, they're building this base knowledge about what's important to their readers, what larger issues affect us as a whole, where voices are needed, where we might have gaps in coverage that definitely need more of our attention. But we're also very modern about how we do this because we're small. We've got to be resourceful. We've got to be savvy. So we turn to social media. We ask, you know, what are people talking about? We follow. We use a number of different resources to give us a better idea of what's trending among the readers and the social users in our communities. But I think there's also, you know, a top level knowledge of what's happening in our state that people here want broken down and put into a local context on. Mm-hmm. So more of our work is based on that than anything else, taking those big ideas, those big issues and breaking it down for our communities.
Let's talk a little bit about social media and the good and the bad and the ugly, because there's, especially as we approach this election, we know there's been such a storm of disinformation that's being spread, regardless where it's coming from. But at this point, I'd rather talk about how do we deal with this disinformation and respond to it. And create trust, of course, with our audience. Do you want to take that, Michelle?
Sure. You know, we're not just dealing with a pandemic, we're dealing with a disinfodemic as well. And people are seeking out, I would call them news sources if I thought they were news, but they're seeking out information sources that agree many times with their own point of view instead of the old-fashioned way, I guess I'll say, of surveying the landscape, digesting the facts, and then arriving at a decision. It's upside down. I have a decision, and now I'm going to look for supporting information to backfill that instead of researching and then arriving at the conclusion. It's a very troubling time, and politics has embedded itself into everything, even our healthcare and our pandemic right now. And social media is certainly a huge part of it. I think that, and this is my personal opinion showing, but I think there have always been people in our society who may have had some very fringe beliefs, but in social media, they find each other, and it bolsters their belief that there's some substance behind things that may not be supportable or documented. And they get more emboldened and they grow their reach. And we have this strange phenomena of trying to shoot down this bad information. Mm-hmm. At the same time, as I said at the beginning, those are the platforms that are eating our lunch. You know, people go to those platforms to find out what's going on in their communities, and they're finding my content there, and they're finding the content from the other panelists there, and they're reaping the award of the financial incentive, the advertiser dollar that used to make its way to our various platforms.
Inez, you spoke earlier, or you have spoken, about the difference between when you come to a newspaper and you read a story, and then there's in the next column or the next page, there's another story that has been kind of, you know, presented to you that the editors at their daily meeting decided that this was something of worth for people to read. And instead, what happens on social media, you read one story and, you know, the logarithms say, ah, now it's your next, if you read this, this is what you want to see now. Can you talk about that and what that means for people coming to the news, to the New Mexican and others?
Sure. What I think is important about the future of journalism in regards to newspapers is that we are a place where people who are trained to how to vet things, to think about news, to think about our community, pull together a variety of sources and a variety of stories. So when you're reading a newspaper, you're going to read something that you didn't seek to read. You're going to read something that you probably disagree with. You're going to read something you don't like that makes you mad, and probably something that makes you smile. And because of that, you go away with a variety of opinions or facts informing what you think about the world. Once you get into only social media dissemination of information, you tend to look, as Michelle said, you look for opinions to bolster what you already think. So where I think we communicate and contribute is by presenting a variety of thoughts and ideas. My job is editing the editorial page, which, you know, Santa Fe is obviously a liberal city in New Mexico. I joke that we get called the corporate media all the time, and I have to say, well, I'll tell that to Robin Martin, the owner of our paper, who lives in Nambe, who is a person and not a corporation. But on our pages, we have a civil conversation about many of the issues. Yes, a lot of the letter writers are very liberal, but we still have conservative writers. We still have moderate writers. We still have a lot of people who aren't interested in politics and only want the mayor to pick the weeds and make sure the streets look clean. So it is a place where the community gathers to talk and to share ideas. And if we can continue to do that, then there's a hope that perhaps we can meet and find solutions. And that's really, Robin, the owner of our paper, really wants my pages and the letters and the opinions to be a place of solutions. So it's not just enough to scream and rant. Yeah. It's you seek for ideas that will help us get to a better place. And that's, I think, a real contribution of journalism. And as Jessica was saying, we are community newspapers. The New Mexican is a very small paper. Just, you know, for New Mexico, we're bigger, but for the world, we're not a big paper. And we have to be at the Little League games just as much as we have to be investigating corruption.
And what makes New Mexican and other papers, especially the Albuquerque Journal as well, so unique is that they are family owned, which is not something that one sees, and to have two such papers, and then there's the Taos News, of course. So right. To have three papers in one state that's family owned, that's actually a very positive thing to say about journalism in this.
And we have the Rio Grande Sun as well in Española, which is owned by the Trap family.
Of course.
And the New Mexican was founded in 1849, so we're the oldest paper in the West. I like to say we got started when the Americans came.
One of the solutions that's been furthered is collaboration. You know, 25 years ago, no newspaper collaborated with any other news organization. It was all about competition, even if you only had two newspapers in a city. And now Searchlight is giving its content away for free. Newspaper reporters from competing or other newspapers constantly work on stories together and further, you know, like very difficult subjects and, you know, put their resources together. How has collaboration affected your work? Inez, do you wanna go ahead?
Sure. That's an interesting question because I don't deal with the news side of it. There's that old wall between news and editorial. So I don't know how they are collaborating. Mm-hmm. I do know that a few years ago, there was that Solutions Journalism Project and we worked with them to do stories about rural New Mexico and New Mexico in general. It makes sense to me that if you can put resources together, you're gonna do a better job and not duplicate. I used to joke that if the 80 people that were sitting at the White House waiting for a handout would come and help us out when we were short-staffed, it would do better for journalism all over the country because we have so many resources concentrated on the same stories. Whereas if we helped each other, we might do better. I know Rebecca, who was one of our reporters who left, she was covering Los Alamos and she got some kind of a partnership with a national media organization and got to,
I believe. Yeah.
That was ProPublica. So she worked a year on an important story about Los Alamos that would not have happened without that. So I think all of these things can help us do a better job. And I know the New Mexican does statehouse coverage, which is sold or shared. I don't even know how that works to other newspapers. So hopefully the fact that we are one of the few state capital papers in the country that still has two statehouse reporters, plus other people coming in on their specialties, is helping the rest of the state get the coverage they need.
How do you feel about the national coverage of the New Mexican? What are the biggest challenges that a regional paper, a capital paper like that actually has?
Well, I think if you have good wire sources, you're in decent shape because, you know, we get the New York Times and the Washington Post and we get their stories and our editors, Phil Casals is the editor of the paper and he and Brian Barker and the other people who work at the paper do a really good job of selecting news. It's not, they don't look at it as like, well, here's what we got today. It's like, what do we want to put in the paper? Mm-hmm. In the 90s, when I was city editor of the New Mexican, we actually had our own Capitol reporter in DC. So that was a nice thing because we could put a New Mexico spin on everything. But those are the kinds of things that have gone away as you continue. So as a regional paper, you have to look for opportunities when it's actually national. Let's say Martin Heinrich is doing a big thing on the interior to step in and take it away from the wire services and do your own thing. So you just have to look and look for opportunities.
You know, it's now 2:45 or just after that. So I would like to open it up, if you don't mind, to questions from the audience, because I think we have quite a few of them at this point. I'm looking at one from Barbara Chatterjee asking how the huge influx of dollars into political campaigns is one of the, I'm not sure now, one of the expenses of newspapers, have journalism outlets. Let's see, Michelle, why don't you take that? That would be a good one for you, I think.
Yeah, I probably should, because you can't turn on your television right now without getting hit with a political ad. It's that time of year. You know, we are built on what we call a biannual cycle. We count on it. Some years it's better than others. Having a CD2 race where you had the same two contenders and it was extremely close last time, we had a feeling that we were going to see a lot of commercials this time around, and it's coming to pass. But when I talk about a biannual cycle, it means that we have a trough year without political revenue. We have a spike year where we get political revenue. And we're one of those last family-owned stations in America. I'm not part of a big group. So we don't have to answer to Wall Street. We actually build a two-year budget. And so we can kind of even it out. I think a lot of the television stations that are in these big nationally publicly traded chains, they have their feast and famine years. In the political year, the money's rolling in and everything's great. And in the non-political year, they're laying people off and they're in austerity mode. We try not to do that. We try to do an even keel, and so we plan on it. This year, political is saving our bacon, you know, because COVID was such a huge deficit to start the year. I mean, we got into March and 50% of the revenue was gone. And so that's just not a business proposition that you can sustain for any period of time. So this should be a year where we're filling the coffer so that we can survive next year in a non-political year. And instead, I'm just eking it out. So I'm really grateful for it. The political's keeping the lights on. It's paying that huge electric bill that I have. But it's not setting me up for next year the way that it should.
Do we have other questions?
I can jump in. One little thing about political ads is just that they don't advertise in newspapers enough, which I always think is a bad idea, because especially like in a place like Taos or in small towns, the readers are voters. So if you want to reach somebody specifically, you're going to do much better with a print ad than you are, you know, spending a lot of money for a wider audience on television. So that is my 2 cents for newspapers.
Here's a question from one somebody in the audience. How do we get the media to begin preparing your viewers and readers now for no winners will be projected on election night? Fred, do you wanna give something to say on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really essential. We don't know how long it's going to take for results at the national level, and even in the case of possibly some local races. Of course, 2 years ago, Michelle mentioned the CD2 race, and the election night, we were under the impression it might be that the Republican was going to be in office, but not all of the absentee ballots had been counted. And when they were, the Democrat, Social Tourist Small, it turned out, won the election. That is a local example of being very careful. And, you know, I guess what we need to do is in this situation is we will, and in the case of KRWG, where we'll have live coverage election night on the radio and online, we will rely on the Associated Press in calling a certain race, but we on our own will simply be reporting what results we have as of the moment we're on the air, and being very careful to, you know, let people know that it isn't over until it's over. Until all the votes are counted, you know, we can't even hint at who we think might have won. We got to be very careful about that. In terms of preparing people, this is important too. We did an hour-long radio call-in show this past week on voting and voter suppression. And I think one of the things that we all fear in journalism, but really we all fear as citizens across the country, is that there might be some races in this election that end up in the courts, and that we need to prepare people for that possibility, and hope that that we're not going there, but that may occur. I mean, we have all been through it with the 2000 election and what happened back then, that it went to the Supreme Court. So these expectations, we've got to be careful to set them that it may be an election week or month, not an election night.
Let me ask a question from Suzanne Prescott, who wonders what role do interns play in keeping news coverage expanded? And Kaylin, I think that would be a great question for you, because I believe you started as a news intern, correct?
Yes, I've interned in several places.
How does that role work?
I guess, is this like career advice? I guess I could give some advice. I guess, you know, there are a lot of angles. I think, like, if you come from if you're interning somewhere in a local community where you do see coverage, I think, like, you know, knowing those types of concerns, I think disinformation and even violence at polling stations is something that a lot of places are trying to prepare for. I think that there are a lot of ways to expand and pitch stories to your editors or fellow reporters. I'm not in the election beat right now. I'm in the COVID beat and the Indigenous Affairs Desk, but that would be my two cents.
Anthony A. is asking, what are newsrooms doing to diversify in New Mexico? Jessica, do you want to take that? I know you don't have a large staff, but it would you still have to think about these questions, don't you?
Yes, we do. So I'm going to assume that he means diversify in terms of the staff that we're hiring. And it's always a concern, because we are living in a state where we want to be able to give voice to those communities and have them represented on our newsroom staffs. But it's a challenge, it really is, because what we're looking for are individuals in the journalism industry with skill set who can fit that need. So in Southeast Mexico, for example, we have a huge Hispanic and Spanish speaking population, which I know we don't serve nearly as well as we should, because we just don't have that skill set. We don't have that skill set on our staff. But we also are in a unique position because we have a huge influx of workers from the oil and gas industry who are representative of multicultures in this region. So, you know, what we attempt to do is to collaborate with those who are able to help us, who have staff that can help fill that gap that we have. But I think as I mentioned before, we're part of the USA Today network, and one of the directives coming down and that we are much more aware of given the what's happening across the country is that we need to be able to, in the future, start looking at how do we hire, how do we get staff that can help us tell those stories, who are comfortable telling those stories, who have skill sets and knowledge to do that as well. In New Mexico, because we have such huge news deserts, as you mentioned before, the key in my mind is always going to be collaboration. Who do I know in my journalism network who can help us do this and do it well? Who can I reach out to who's willing to help us reach that audience and better tell that story?
A related question to all of this is from Pamela Pereira, and it has to do with the digital divide and how we're following that conversation in our coverage. I will just say, you know, from Searchlight's perspective, We've covered it in a couple ways. One has been our stories about the census, which we started more than a year ago. And as everything has just kind of come to a, you know, like a near peak, the digital divide is a very big problem, of course. But it's also a huge problem now with education and remote learning. And we've just published or about to publish a story about how schools around the state, and as we're looking at Española, are having these, you know, like serious problems where kids, you know, there isn't enough bandwidth in one person's house for all the children to go online at the same time and study. So they're being sent to grandparents and to friends and aunties and uncles in order that, you know, like whole families are being kind of just every day sent, you know, around the community just so that they can, you know, try to get that coverage. But others, what about, I don't know, Inez, how is the New Mexican addressing the digital divide in New Mexico?
Editorially speaking, our position has been for years that there should have been some kind of a push at the state level using federal, local, and state dollars to improve the digital divide. And had Governor Martinez listened to our sound advice, everyone would be a lot better off now, because we wrote about problems with, you know, getting the internet to tribal communities, to rural communities in parts of Santa Fe. We weren't doing enough. And it's one of those things that you can get economic development, you can get education, just so many opportunities if you have fast internet. What we do about the digital divide as a paper is that we still deliver to really out of the way places in print, because otherwise those people don't have access to news, because there's places in just around Santa Fe where you can't get good internet. So we understand that even though digital might be the future, right now we have to print a newspaper, because otherwise there are people who will not be able to read news. You know, more specifically to what I do, I have some old people that don't have a computer that want to write letters. So they handwrite really tiny, cryptic, bad handwriting that you can't read. And I type them. And then sometimes I call them and say, I can't read your handwriting, dictate your letter to me. And I always joke, I don't think at the New York Times, they let old people call in and dictate their letters. But we want everyone to have access to our paper if we can. And that means, you know, going above and beyond, even if it's not always easy.
And when it comes to news deserts, do you have any thoughts, anybody among you panelists, to a question from Rachel Thompson about the these news deserts and whether New Mexico actually used to have a more vibrant local weekly newspaper community? Fred?
Yeah, you know, I mean, earlier it was mentioned the Solutions Journalism Network worked collaboratively with organizations across the state a few years back on a project called State of Change. And we looked together a variety of newspapers, as well as KRWG, my organization, and KNME up in Albuquerque, at how New Mexico was changing, and tried to cover some issues that might have been missed about how our state was changing and how we could progress, especially economically. You know, I think that collaboration is key in trying to fill these news deserts. I also think that philanthropy is going to be more and more important. And working together not only on things as involved as State of Change, but also just sharing content where you can. We're very grateful in Southern New Mexico because KOB is sharing its political debates with KRWG. We're able to run their CD2 debate and their US Senate debate so that our viewers down here can see the, those programs. Otherwise, they would not be able to see them because many of our viewers are on cable systems that get the affiliates from El Paso, not from Albuquerque. So they would otherwise not be able to see that content. And so we're really grateful to that. And that, you know, to me, it should be a much more common thing, because we can never forget that the public owns the airwaves, right? I mean, they're the ones who own the airwaves, not the commercial broadcasters. They get a temporary license to use the signal. And so that's part of the responsibility of being a broadcaster, indeed.
Michelle, there's a question for you here from Melissa Segura. As someone who cares deeply about New Mexico and its policing culture, I've noticed what seems like a definite shift in tone and coverage generally, and crime coverage specifically. For example, the boomerang thug packages set the public against research-based ball reform. What explains what seems like a shift in tone over recent years?
Well, I wouldn't say that those that series of reports was against research-based bail reform. We did a lot of investigative work on the need for research-based bail reform, and we've done more about people being locked up in prison because they can't afford to get out, I think, than any other television station. I think the danger is in taking one slice of one day and saying that represents a point of view. It's kind of what we've been talking about. We definitely had a problem with catch and release criminals, and it's real. And if you talk to people who did the research on research-based bail reform, they will tell you that 15% of the criminals are responsible for 85% of the crimes. So that is a very real phenomenon. I would say too that we've done a lot of work that was very critical of policing and have taken our lumps for it. I point to the shooting of the Foothills camper as one where we broke a lot of ground on that story, and it really divided our community deeply. And it wasn't that we were taking sides, we were reporting what we uncovered as we uncovered it. So I would hope that people would look at the body of our work and say over time that we're just doing our best to bring important issues as we discover them, research them fully and bring them to the fore, and not assume that we're taking one side or another. But I want to make an observation, because as I reflect on the conversation of the last 5 minutes or so, it's really overlaps if you think about what we're talking about here, because we've got the news deserts and we've got a diversity problem, we've got collaboration, and we've got a digital divide, and it's really all the same issue attacked from different sides. I remember 20 years ago, President Clinton standing there, a beautiful picture at Shiprock, and talking about the digital divide and how America was going to solve that 20 years ago. And here we are, and in many ways, we're in worse shape than ever, and we're more dependent on our digital tools than ever. So the collaboration that we're very open to, I think, is a big piece of it, reaching into these communities and making sure that they're a part of the editorial process, making sure that that's represented. You know, as we went through COVID, I have at least three people, maybe more, on my staff who speak Navajo, who were able to go into that community and cover the crisis there. These issues are all kind of the same issue, taking it from a different side. And I guess after 20 years of saying we're going to do something about it, the rubber meets the road this year, because economically we must in order to survive.
I think Michael Marcotte has his hand up. Is there a way to just highlight him? No? Here's a question from an anonymous attendee. We lost our print newspaper and our local radio station on the same day last month. What are the larger news outlets doing in the state to make up for the loss of local media? And in a related question, how can the public, people in the public, help further the work of investigative journalism? Jessica?
That is a great question. Let me say, it's one of the things that we struggle with as well. The Carlsbad Current Argus specifically, when we look at how our nearest neighbors are doing when it comes to covering news and the state of their newsrooms, it's sad to see. Artesia, just a town over, they went completely online and stopped publishing altogether. Roswell, a little further north than us, lost their Sunday edition. And I know that all the personnel in all the other local newsrooms, Lovington, Hobbs, have scaled back. So we're very intentional about taking what we're working on and trying to give it a regional reach. And when we say regional, how do we make this valid not only for our audience, but how do we help it inform people in Artesia and Hobbs and Roswell and even further north, where there's no news coverage at all? That's one way we do it. But then we're also very intentional about taking a step back instead of digging into what we have to that day and taking a step back and saying, okay, let's look at the communities around us. What is there to cover that needs coverage that we can no longer ignore? What are people calling for when it comes to more information in those areas where they don't have a local newspaper or they're not getting their local radio station? And it's tough because you want to be able to focus on your community and the items that are important to them, but it's also very important work. Too much slips by when you don't do that. Too many important things don't get highlighted when you're not able to say, how can we help fill those gaps? Definitely. And I think also we've all been saying this word, collaboration, and it's very important. But among that collaboration, I think we're all on the same page when it comes to our job is to inform and do the best that we can. And that takes planning and that takes a devotion of resources that not all of us have. But we also have to be willing to make those really tough decisions of what can't we afford to do now? What can we dive into, say, deeper in an investigative or enterprise piece that'll take us a few more months, but which will still accomplish that larger goal? It's a question that, you know, it kind of haunts us every day. We're looking at our larger section of Eddy County, Lee, Chavez in this corner of the state, and asking what can we do better and how can we do it better?
That's a really good point. I'd like to go now to Michael Marcotte, who's one of the most influential journalism educators in New Mexico. He teaches at UNM, and he had some comments that he wanted to make, which I think is a good way to end it, because we're amazingly at the 1.5 hour mark. Yeah.
Well, thanks for piping me in. I've been enjoying the conversation. I teach at the University of New Mexico in the Communication Journalism Department. Christian Marquez, who now works for you guys at Searchlight, kind of looped me in. Wasn't expecting it, but here I am. My question was, and maybe I'll just turn it around to a comment, is that I think, you know, more and more as journalism is changing and we've lost sort of like, you know, the gatekeeper function where, you know, we own all the means of journalism. Everybody owns some element of it now. And I still believe, of course, in the professional journalist function. I think of it more and more like an ecosystem, and that we have to develop our collaborative connections to each other and to our community organizations and to our public. But a key part of that ecosystem, I think, is the journalism school. And I enjoin others to help me in fighting the good fight, not just to elevate the skills of our students so that they can go out into the world, our diverse students who can go out into the world and help produce good journalism, but how can journalism schools play a more integral role in the industry and in the ecosystem, the broader ecosystem? So I guess I'm just putting it on the table that I see it as our mission in journalism programs. NMSU has a great one. Eastern New Mexico has a strong one. We've got our program in Albuquerque, that we work together to do more to support each other in helping journalism go well for our communities. And I just think there's so much more we can do, but we need the public support, we need the industry support, and we need to continue to get students into the career pipeline. And right now we're really worried about them being turned off by journalism because of the way it's portrayed.
Well, we are at the 1.5 hour mark. It's almost 3:15. And I know that nobody can stand being on Zoom for more than an hour and a half. So we're going to call it. Thank you all for being here, both participants and panelists. I think we've really sharpened our understanding about what's happening in journalism, at least here in New Mexico, but what's happening here is happening everywhere. I'm sorry I wasn't able to take the questions of everybody who threw them into the ring. I hope maybe we can do this again sometime soon, because things are really developing fast, and I don't imagine that journalism is going to stand still. So thank you, and stay safe, all of you. Bye-bye.